Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of A Cast to the Past, where best friends get together to talk about old games in a new light. I'm Josh.
And I'm Tom.
And once again, we are going to be doing a different type of episode. Today, we're going to be giving top 10 list.
Yeah, call us a BuzzFeed employee because this is a listicle, baby.
What was that other website that does them? WatchMojo.
Oh, yeah, except we don't suck.
Hey, I like WatchMojo.
Oh, no, Josh, we can't be friends anymore.
Oh, no. Well, that was
no.
It. This is the end of the podcast. Great job.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you never. Bye-bye.
So, Tom, what is our top 10 list today?
All right. We are going to be discussing underrated gems that we would highly recommend for people to play, like, today. Like, you should be playing these games. You should have already played these games. And we're going to tell you why.
All right. Fair enough. So how did you create your list, Tom?
I just looked back to, I basically combed backwards more or less through my achievement library and through my personal like physical collection. And I was looking, I was like, no AAA titles, you know, nothing of critical acclaim. I just, you know, find a game that I remember really liking and I feel like nobody talks about. Or maybe it's a game from a series that came and went too quick and nobody even remembers it.
Okay.
And I was just like, you know, I want to champion these games. I want to give them a little bit of a signal boost, get them out into, you know, get them out to gamers so maybe they'll try them. What about you, Josh? What was your criteria for what made the cut?
So the games that made the cut for me have been, well, looking at my collection is... it took me a while to find. Like I said, at one point in time, my list was... over 20 games that I had for our top 10 list. So narrowing them down took a lot for me. The games that I picked were games that people don't really talk about or really never talk about at all, but they have maybe some sort of a resurgence here and there. The same way that, let's say, Earthbound would have a resurgence, you know, where people... oh, it's that really expensive Super Nintendo game. It's, you know, and then now all of a sudden it's, you know, critically acclaimed as one of the greatest games of all time. It's one of those games that like went kind of just flat out and nothing came from it. And, you know, I remember having a wonderful time with it or still having a wonderful time with it. And it left such a memorable piece to me that I want other people to play this game because they are missing out on something amazing.
I get you. Well, just like Ashley Simpson, we're going to get those pieces of you and we're going to share them with our audience today. And it's going to be great.
So Tom, I'm going to let you start off our top 10 list. I feel I'm like in the giving mood today. So I'm going to give you the opportunity to hit me with your number 10.
All right, well, this hit that I'm about to get you is not so much a hit, it's more of a chair shot. And I want to talk about WrestleMania 18 on the Nintendo GameCube. Now, this was the first major WWE-branded wrestling release on Nintendo's GameCube system. And a funny thing about it that I remember to this day is that the packaging and everything in the game came with the WWF label, but this was like released like 3 months after
the change.
Yeah, World Wildlife Fund, I guess like their deal with them ended. They couldn't use WWF anymore or they were going to get sued. So boom, they became WWE. But this was a seminal wrestling game for me because it was the first next gen wrestling game I had picked up at the time after WrestleMania 2000. And I loved getting to play with some of the more modern roster, you know, Brock Lesnar, Rob Van Dam, NWO, Hogan, Nash and Hall returning to WWE. It doesn't have much of an in-depth story mode to write home about, which it suffers in comparison to, say, you know, the critically acclaimed SmackDown series on the PlayStation at the time. But for, like, you know, Nintendo fans at the time, it was a really great option to have just some fun, kind of arcadey, you know, wrestling action with lots of match types. You know, you could do Hell in a Cell, you could do ladders. They had a pretty good create a wrestler. I could be wrong, but I think they also had create a title. And it was just fun for multiplayer. It was fun for exhibition, just kicking around, stuff like that. And I just remember I have very fond memories of this game. And it's something that I think anyone looking into kind of like the history of wrestling games should definitely pick up. It's absolutely worth it in my book.
Yeah, what console did that come out on? That was the GameCube?
Just the GameCube. Yep, okay. that was their exclusive for a while. Because
I was going to say, because they had the Day of Reckoning games before that, right?
That was later. That was like 04, 05, okay. Yeah. But when it started, it was the GameCube had the WrestleMania branded games, PlayStation had the SmackDown branded games, and Xbox had the Raw branded games. Yeah.
Featuring Fred Durst,
the iconic Hall of Fame wrestler.
Now, that's actually a good pick because, like, not that many people really do talk about the WrestleMania games. They are actually pretty decent.
Mm-hmm.
I was a SmackDown person growing up because I thought Here Comes the Pain was one of the greatest wrestling games next to WrestleMania 2000,
sure,
of that time frame. But, yeah, I mean, I even enjoyed WWF Royal Rumble on the Dreamcast.
Oh, that is a gem of gems.
Yeah. You know?
Well, that's my first pick out of the way. Josh, I am itching to hear yours. I want to know what you picked first. Tell me.
So the game that I chose for number 10 did for hospitals what Roller Coaster Tycoon did for amusement parks. And that is Theme Hospital.
Interesting. Tell me about that.
Theme Hospital, that you create your own hospital. And you staff your people inside of it. And it has this awesome, quirky British humor in it. So let's say someone shows up at your hospital with a giant inflatable head. Well, how are you going to cure him? You have to hire a doctor who can grab a needle and pop his head. And then put a new head on top of him. Like, it's stuff like that that's inside the game that just is so fun and so enjoyable. And like, you see like Def just walking around the halls of your hospital as you're trying to like save patients from dying. And it's just, it's really fun and enjoyable. Like I said, the humor is on point for it. And there was a spiritual successor that came out 2 years ago, just recently hit the Xbox, which was Two Point Hospital. If you enjoy this game or enjoy like that type of humor, that is perfect because it is a quick, just go in, play for a little bit, kind of come out, just get a couple good laughs. I know in like the Two Point Hospital one where there's a person that has like an imposter like type syndrome where they turn into Freddie Mercury and they have to talk to a therapist to not be Freddie Mercury again. Like, it's just stuff like that. That's just super enjoyable. And it's just that dry British humor that's just so good in it. And I think Theme Hospital deserves to be on a hidden gem list.
That's great. I you know me, you know I love dry, wacky British humor. I mean, after all, the British office is better than the American office. Let's just speak the truth here.
I'm not gonna argue anything there.
You don't want to get destroyed by the internet. I understand. I'll speak up.
Look, Tom's with the hot takes now. Tom's saying the hot takes, not me.
Rest in peace, Tom. But I do remember you recommending Two Point Hospital, and it's interesting to hear that it had a kind of a successor. Did this kind of operate at a bird's eye view, like, because you compared it to Roller Coaster Tycoon?
Yes.
Is it like this big, you're a god looking down?
Yeah, you can spin the cameras around and stuff like that and get a little bit deeper into the hospital too, so it's you get different planes of view. And you get to the point where you can build multiple hospitals. So you have different sections and wings and stuff like that to it, which is awesome though. But with Two Point Hospital, the same people who made Theme Hospital made that. So it was like, hey, you won't let us make another one. We'll make our own.
Yeah. That's really good. I love that. I love that, that ambition, determination. Like, we're just going to keep going.
Yeah.
Recycle a winning idea and just add on top of it. That's good stuff. Good stuff.
So there was a animated movie starring Elijah Wood called Nine.
Oh, yes, there was.
What is your number 9?
Well, it's not a Tim Burton produced weird dystopian animated movie about sack boys, but what it is, now this is one of two things on my list that I'm going to put a big old asterisk on, because I want to preface this with, I know this is from a major AAA game that did see a degree of critical acclaim. But the reason I've picked this is because I feel like it has faded into obscurity reputation-wise, even though it's gotten, like, you know, a recent remaster. And that's L.A. Noire.
Okay.
The Rockstar game set in 1940s Los Angeles, in which you play a rising detective who, you know, bounces between different departments within the LAPD and solves crimes. And you solve the crimes via this interrogation system that's based around, you know, asking questions, engaging the reactions of the characters you're questioning. And this was all built around a very advanced 360-degree facial capture system that was groundbreaking at the time. I still think it's pretty cool. There's an example of it that's kind of been memed to death of a guy who's whose lying face is so over the top that you like know he's lying.
Yeah.
But this was a really cool game whose like crime investigation and detective work was just so thrilling and so engaging that like I got caught up in it, and I would get aggravated if I botched a case or I botched an interrogation because you can do that. Like, there's a goal to, like, you know, try to perfect every case, but you can mess things up and it kind of will play with the narrative. The bits about it that I would admit don't fully work are that, you know, it also tries to be like this open world GTA-esque game where you can drive through all of 1940s Los Angeles, and it's not always necessary. Like, I think the detective aspects of it and the investigation and the kind of puzzle riddle solving way better than any of the kind of gun combat. But this is a game I feel that gets slept on a lot. You know, Rockstar keeps remaking Grand Theft Auto 5 for console after console. And even though they gave us the miracle that was Red Dead 2, I just kind of feel like L.A. Noire is on the verge of being forgotten, and I want to kind of push it back up to the top. It's like, don't forget about this game.
Do you think we're ever going to get L.A. Noire 2?
I do not at all.
You think we're going to get a Bully 2?
Nope. Unless something crazy happens with Rockstar, I think they're just kind of locked into GTA for right now.
Yeah, I loved L.A. Noire when I played it. I never finished it because I had the end spoiled for me, and I was like, okay. But I enjoyed my time all the way up to it. I think I got, it was on the Xbox, it was multiple disc. I think I got to the second disc for it.
It's a big, beefy game. Yeah. So, Josh, I think it's time for you to give me 9.
So, my number 9 is a Sega Genesis game called Haunting, starring Poltergeist.
Okay.
And it's a game about this rad, cool kid who skateboards all the time, who ended up dying and becoming a ghost or a poltergeist.
What a pleasant beginning.
Yes. But the object of the game is to get the family that moves into this house. You're haunting this one particular family all the time. And you have to constantly keep getting them out of the house. So, like, you'll go ahead and you'll warp inside of a toilet, and then the toilet will grow eyes and teeth and stuff like that, and starts. And you have to scare the people out of the house, like each member of the family. Or, like, you have a tablecloth. You jump into the tablecloth and you jump out of it, and then the tablecloth just starts bleeding all over the floor and stuff like that. It's really funny, and, like, there's a lot of humor behind it. You can definitely tell it's a 90s game, the way that everything's extreme and stuff. But it's really funny. It's practically Beetlejuice for the Sega Genesis.
Okay. But if the ghost in this case was, like, you know, young John Connor from the beginning of Terminator 2, just being like a little
like
bad boy.
Simpson.
Bart Simpson? Okay. Okay.
It's a great game, though. It is one of those games. When I started doing my retro game collecting, that was like the first Genesis game I was trying to track down. And it's so hard to find, but it is definitely worth it if you play it. You just want to have a good laugh at the awesomeness that is the 90s.
Well, as soon as you started describing it, it sounded like a game that was right up your alley, because I know how you feel about Splatterhouse and Sweet Home. And the second you were like, interesting concept involving something supernatural with a great pun based name.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, this is totally Josh's cup of tea. So that's awesome.
It's pretty much like a dad joke inside of Ghost.
That's awesome. All right. Good stuff.
Isn't it great if you gave me your number 8?
Oh, well, let's see if I can appreciate this next title. This is my favorite entry within this franchise, a franchise that I kind of think is like on death's door. I want people to play SSX Tricky. This was an EA sports game from 2001, 2002-ish. Came out on the PS1. My bad. It came out on the PS2, GameCube, and Xbox. And it was a snowboarding game At the time, my best comparison was like, you know, this is like, you know, it's like what Tony Hawk's Pro Skater was doing for skateboarding, this was doing for snowboarding. I had not been aware previously of like the SSX series that kind of approaches snowboarding a little bit more seriously. But with Tricky, they kind of went all out with this really goofy, over the top, fun aesthetic. All the snowboarders were like these really colorful, unique characters who could do these insane special moves if you pulled off like the perfect series of combos and stuff.
Yep.
It had an awesome soundtrack, great courses to both race down and do tricks on. It was one of those games where I was constantly renting it from Hollywood Video, and I should have just bought it because I probably spent more money on the rentals than in actually buying it. But SSX Tricky, a ton of fun, something that I think, you know, the SSX series kind of went back to being more serious after that.
Yep.
I can't really explain why. I guess it has its audience, and if you're into kind of more serious focused snowboarding games, great. I'm not going to shame any of you for that.
Right.
But Tricky for me was where I really connected.
Yeah, Tricky's so good. Mm-hmm. Every now and then I get that urge where I'm like, you know what, just that goofiness, you know what I mean, behind everything. And it's just like, okay, just put it in, turn your brain off, just have fun.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about those early 2000 games, those extreme sports games, where it's just turn your brain off and just go and have fun. And just, it doesn't matter what physics are, like you're doing kick flips and you're spinning the board way it detaches from your feet. Like,
it's great. The one character does a worm on his snowboard. Yeah, exactly. In midair. It's phenomenal. I love it. Yeah, absolutely. I like when games are not afraid to just go over the top and have fun. And Tricky is very fun. Yes.
I gotta hit you with my number eight, Tom, and mm-hmm. I got five words for you. Bury me with my money.
Oh, are we riding up for a ride into the sunset?
Howdy, partner. It is Sunset Riders, the best Western game ever. Screw you, Red Dead Redemption. We got Sunset Riders. And you know how good Sunset Riders is? It's so good that they're re-releasing it on the Switch coming out in the next couple months with multiplayer. So we'll be able to enjoy it all over again. It's the best Western. It is an awesome beat 'em up in the time frame that like Turtles in Time and everything came out. So it was at the golden age of them beat 'em ups. Memorable lines, memorable characters, the awesome different guns that each of the four main characters had. Like every character played differently. And that was like Konami's peak. When it came to their beat-em-ups, they had Turtles in Time, they had Sunset Riders, they had X-Men, they had the Simpsons games, they had everything. That was the pinnacle of it. But Sunset Riders, not only is the arcade edition of it awesome, but the console version for the Super Nintendo specifically, not the Genesis version, the Super Nintendo version is fantastic beat-em-up fun.
And some of the most creative and unique bosses in all of gaming with, like, you know, I know you opened it up with one of their most famous catchphrases, but all the bosses are super hilarious and fun to fight.
So over the top.
Yeah. Love it. Absolutely love that choice. Excellent. I got nothing to say. Just excellent. Definitely play that.
All right. So are we in heaven? Because I'm looking for Tom's number seven.
My number seven is unintentionally a 007. That's right. You all want to talk about how great GoldenEye is, and GoldenEye was fine when you were 10, but let's talk about 007 Nightfire.
Okay.
The James Bond game released within the window of the PS2, GameCube, and Xbox era, bearing Pierce Brosnan's likeness on the cover and bearing Pierce Brosnan's likeness within the game, because they had the rights to that, but having a hilariously not Pierce Brosnan voice actor. But no, it's a great original kind of James Bond adventure with really good first-person gunplay, a unique variety of weapons and Bond-inspired gadgets, and it has a pretty dang good multiplayer mode, too. Every year that I go to Magfest, a friend of the show, Mark Gilger, and I, like, we'll go to the console room and be like, can we get a copy of Nightfire? And they're like, what console? It's like, we just don't care. Just give us a copy of Nightfire. And we'll replay the multiplayer modes. There was a series of, like, pretty good Bond games in this era. There was Agent Under Fire. There was Nightfire. There was Everything or Nothing, which was really unique in that that was a third person Bond game starring Pierce Brosnan with his actual like voice acting provided, and also featuring John Cleese and Willem Dafoe in the game as well. That was like literally like a unique Bond movie brought to life. But Nightfire is this really fun James Bond adventure that it's easy to pick up and play. It's, you know, it's much better than Die Another Day, which Pierce Brosnan was doing around the same time on the big screen.
Right.
So yeah, if you want to have a fun little Bond adventure, jump into Nightfire.
So that was an original story, right?
I mean, like an original story for that game. Yes.
Yeah.
I
don't know if it's
based on any of the novels or anything. Moving on from 007 to Josh's 7. What do you got?
So my number 7 is 3D.GameHero for the PlayStation 3. Now, a lot of people, when this first came out, they didn't know what this was because it was 2D side-scrolling like adventure game that looked like the original Legend of Zelda, but then it went kind of isometrical and it became a 3D version of the original Legend of Zelda style game. Everyone considers it a Zelda-like game because it is like you move from screen to screen to screen to screen, getting pieces and items and stuff like that to restore this kingdom. And the cool part of it is you can create your own 3D.GameHero in the game by using their custom character thing, which everyone pretty much just made Link in it because it's just Link in a PlayStation 3 game. But you can create your own characters. But the craziest thing about it, guess who created the game?
Who?
From Software.
Oh, they have recently moved up in your book, haven't they?
They have. They've climbed the mountain right now. It's so crazy, though. Like, it is such a great game. If you're looking for that Zelda 1 or Link to the Past type game, because it's a lot of humor in it, and there's a lot of spoofs in this game that are callbacks to, you know, Zelda, Mario, so on and so on and so on. It is just it's a wonderful game that just tugs on your nostalgic heartstrings.
So, quick question. You mentioned it goes from 2D to 3D. Are we talking like in a Super Paper Mario kind of style where, like, you know, you can switch the dimensional perspective?
No,
like that?
So let's say you're looking at the screen like the original Legend of Zelda, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then let's just say the backdrop of it goes down. So it's that, but in a 3D world.
Okay.
Is the best way to kind of describe it.
Okay.
It's imagine if the original Legend of Zelda was in 3D.
I think I'm getting a better perspective. I hope if you're listening to the audio version of this, you get it too, and, you know, but like,
one really funny thing about it is like you constantly keep getting sword upgrades through killing people and stuff. And your sword gets to the point where it will take up like 3/4 of the screen because it just gets so overly ridiculously big that you could just, it just wipes out everything that's on the map. But just
nice.
It's just a great action adventure game.
I like that. Okay. Thank you for telling me about that.
I don't got a pun for number 6, Tom. So just tell me what your number 6 is.
My number 6 is, based off of the 6th film in the Middle Earth series, if you're going by the inclusion of the Hobbit movies, but JK, I don't include the Hobbit movies for anything. Mine is what I consider to probably be the one of, if not the best movie tie-in games of all time. And that is Lord of the Rings, Return of the King for that era, you know, the PlayStation 2, Xbox, GameCube. You should notice a theme in a lot of my picks. Mm-hmm. I'm settling on a very specific period of history
where I have
a lot of love for games that came out on these consoles. You know, at the time, I think this was like one of the most faithful movie adaptations I had ever seen, where they recreated all the excitement and the drama level to level of this game. And they found really creative ways to take sequences from the film of like both stealth and action and turn them into really engaging levels. And, you know, they had all your favorite characters from the films. They had a really interesting and well thought out upgrade system for like their weapons and their abilities that was fun to build upon. And it was just something like fun to both like play over and over again, like watching the movie over and over again. You could throw this in and just go on an adventure with Frodo and Aragorn, and it was just really good stuff. And in certain levels, you can even the ability to switch between characters. You know, like you start a level as Aragorn and you're handling like a nice mix of like ranged and melee combat. But then you want to go pure range. Boom, you're Legolas. You want to go pure melee. Boom, you're Gimli. You know, like it was very flexible. And I think EA did a really good job. I never thought I'd be praising EA so much in an episode. But like, you know, at one point they were pretty admirable. Yeah. And I think Return of the King's one of their better efforts from that era.
Yeah, I remember playing Two Towers a lot. And mm-hmm. I played Fellowship, too, on the original Xbox. I mean, I never played Return of the King.
so it's interesting.
I'll take your word, though, for it.
Yeah, what's interesting is Fellowship was from a different developer. Mm-hmm. Two Towers is when EA got it, and that was good. Mm-hmm. But, like, Return of the King, like, improved upon what they did in Towers
right.
in every way. So,
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, Josh, is there anything on your list next that you would put a crown on top of?
So my number 6... is Parasite Eve for the PlayStation 1.
Okay, I am familiar at least a bit with this game, but tell me more about it. I want to learn.
Coming off the heels of Final Fantasy VII, a year and a half later, Squaresoft releases Parasite Eve. Parasite Eve is an action-adventure RPG with survival horror elements set in Manhattan. Like, right there. Okay, you got me. Action RPG, survival horror, Resident Evil, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
and New York. Like, what could go wrong? it's a great game. The battle mechanics are so unique where it's kind of turn-based, but you can also, like, run away and dodge the enemies and stuff as you're going through. It's kind of that first start that you see of the like the newer Final Fantasies and stuff like that, how RPGs have become action adventures where you're not constantly getting hit back and forth all the time, or you actually can move around. It's a great story, and it is praised for the cutscenes in the game. And I'll tell you right now, if you guys are iffy about a game like this, watch the cutscenes. Specifically, the opening opera scene is just fantastic to see that was able to be portrayed on a PlayStation 1 console. It is just amazing with just how well done that game is. It is pretty much Silent Hill meets Final Fantasy VII.
Oh, now that's a pitch. Like, okay.
that's the only way I can kind of describe it for you.
All right. I'm a big fan of cutscenes, so I'm definitely gonna have to check that out and see what I'm missing.
All right, we're halfway there, Tom.
Oh, so I guess I should get us moving then. The next game comes from a developer known as Ubisoft.
Mm.
They're mm. They're a notable French developer.
Ubisoft.
Ubisoft. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So this is actually the first time that its main characters got their own official starring effort. And we talked about this on the show previously, but I want to recommend Rabbids Go Home.
Oh, okay.
So this is the game that takes the rabbits, those crazy little rabbits from the Rayman games, and it gives them their own adventure. And so basically you find out a little bit more about the rabbits, and the chief thing you find out is that they're dumb. And they live in a garbage dump in like, this unidentified city. And they think they one night they just look up at the moon and they decide that's where we came from. And they want to go back.
Okay.
And so the purpose of the game is that you control two rabbits, like one in a shopping cart, and the other one pushing the shopping cart. And you're unleashed just in these like random levels, like a shopping mall, a grocery store, city streets. And the goal is to cause a lot of damage and pick up the debris you make. And basically, like, it's kind of similar to Katamari Damacy in that, like, you're just trying to accumulate as much stuff. But the overall goal of the game is to help the rabbits make a pile of trash so big that they can climb back up to the moon.
Okay.
And it is just, it's very funny. It's incredibly charming. This is a Wii exclusive game. And it took advantage of the Wiimote in some creative, unique ways. There's even a mode where like the camera will cut to the inside of your Wiimote and a rabbit will appear in there. And if you shake the Wiimote, he'll bounce around the 3D rendered interior of the Wiimote. And then the little speaker, you'll hear like, ar, 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 ar. So it's a really charming and fun game and probably the best like spotlight the rabbits ever got before, you know, Despicable Me ripped off the concept and created the Minions. And then, the rabbits just kind of disappeared. So absolutely recommend that.
Do you think it might turn a lot of people away because it is on the Wii?
I mean, you know, a lot of people make the case that like, oh, the Wii wasn't good because it didn't have.
Oh, I'm not saying it wasn't. Like,
oh, no, let me hear me out. What I mean is that like a lot of people who like would poo-poo the Wii would be like, they didn't have a lot of good third-party exclusives, and I would just immediately be like, rabbits go home.
What is it? The block game. Boom Blocks. Okay. Well, you've talked about something that's on my list too already. So.
Okay. Fair enough. All right. But Ubisoft did help the Wii out a bit.
Yeah.
And if it turns you off that it's on the Wii, well, I'm sorry, you're missing out.
Hey, Ubisoft was one of the only companies. Ubisoft was the only company that like supported the Wii U. So give them respect. Rayman Legends came out on the Wii U.
And it's great.
It is great.
We have an episode on it. You should listen to it. So, Josh, we got to move right along. What do you got up next?
Number 5 is the best soundtrack of the 2010s in video games.
Oh, okay.
And that soundtrack is accompanied by a game called Sayonara Wild Hearts.
Oh, okay. I have heard of this just from a lot of the buzz it generated around its release. Was it last year?
Yeah, it was released, I think, the beginning of last year, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
It is a killer soundtrack. I constantly am playing it in my car. Before we started the podcast, I listened to the soundtrack twice. I was just sitting here playing the Pokemon trading card game and just listening to the soundtrack. It is just fantastic. Daniel Olsen, his music with Leanna Olsen's vocals combined are just so goosebump inducing.
Mm.
It's just so like the songs are so catchy that you think they should be on the radio. They're that good. And the gameplay mixes with it. It's a rhythmic game, like kind of like a rail shooter without the shooting, but you're going from track to track trying to collect all of these gems so you can battle these people who gave the main character a heartbreak. And it's just awesome that the way that the story is, and it's so cool. Like, it's kind of a spoiler, but if you even look up anything on the game, you're going to see it automatically. You have a narrator through the entire game that kind of just tells you about like what's going on, how good you're doing and stuff like that. And at the very end, when the credits are going, it pops up and it's going to be like, you think it's going to fade out and it's going to say, thanks for playing. And then the thing pops up and it says narrated by Queen Latifah. And I was like, shit, like she backed this game. Like, I was like, damn, like, okay. Like, it's just so good. It's a game with music that puts you in a feel good mood no matter how sad the main character is in the game.
Interesting. I liked basically everything I heard about that, so yeah. I'm definitely gonna move forward to try to get that into my lineup. Thank you so much for recommending that.
No problem.
Mm-hmm.
Number 4.
Oh,
who's leading off your four horsemen?
Well, you know, the first is The God of Hollywood, because Steven Spielberg brought us this next game, and it is Boom Blocks for the Nintendo Wii. This is such a cool and unique game that Spielberg developed, and I was so upset at how quickly this kind of just disappeared. I even remember at the time, you know, good reviews, interesting concepts, and it, you know, just like sales are super low and it looks like we're not continuing the series. Boom. I mean, I know it got like a small follow-up, but that's it. Like, this could have been a big brand that could have continued to this day, and for some reason it didn't. But so Boom Blocks is kind of centered around these physics-based puzzle games wherein you know, there are towers made out of like block-shaped animals, and you have to kind of play them in a kind of like a reverse Jenga format. You're either trying to dismantle your tower as fast as you can, sometimes in multiplayer modes before your opponent, or even like protect and preserve your tower. You know what I mean? It's kind of, besides the Jenga comparison, it was kind of a little bit like Angry Birds before Angry Birds, you know?
Yeah.
And it used the Wiimote really well. I can only imagine what would have happened if this game had stuck around long enough to get the Wiimote with the new enhanced motion sensor, because this probably would have made this game even better. But yeah, this was a super fun and easy to pick up and get into party game that could appeal to anybody. And for some reason, you know, gaming community just like turned it away. And it was another strong, in my opinion, strong Wii exclusive title. And it's just a shame that it kind of disappeared. And I would easily say, if you got a Wii or a Wii U and you're looking for something to kind of like, you know, get yourself into with friends, Boom Blocks is totally worth it.
Yeah, Boom Blocks, I never played it, but I know the hype behind it.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those games, too, that when you see a best of Wii games, Boom Blocks is usually on it. Like, it's up there with your Mario Galaxies, your Twilight Princess, so on and so on. Like, Boom Blocks is just, it was a surprise hit that kind of fizzled out really quick, which makes it a hidden gem.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, I'm sure Steven Spielberg's not losing any sleep over it, but I know he's a gamer, and I'm sure the ability to, like, you know, be involved in a game was probably a big thing for him, and then didn't work out, so maybe he was a little bummed about it, but, you know,
life
goes on. And this list goes on, so Josh, what do you have up for me next?
Number four is one of the best modern-day love stories. Mixed with a murder mystery. And that is Firewatch.
Ah, okay.
An indie title that blew my mind when I was playing it. I was like, okay, this is kind of boring. I understand what's going on. Okay, well, I'm actually more intrigued with this, the main character's relationship now. Okay, what? Like, you uncover something so crazy that your mind just starts going so many different ways of how's this, like, what's following me? Something's watching me. Who's this? Who's, like, so on and so on and so on. It keeps you guessing all the way up into the end. And when you get to the end, you have multiple different choices that you can actually make. I'm not going to spoil any of them, but
sure.
It's a very tense game when it gets to the end. And I think just the love story, well, kind of love story that happens throughout the whole game, just is one of the best relationship building things with someone just over a communicator. You know what I mean? It's just one of those things that just words between your character and this other character. It's the best love story since 500 Days of Summer.
Okay.
Is
okay.
The best way to.
I mean, that's kind of an anti. Okay. This isn't an in-depth review of 500 Days of Summer, but I get what you're going for.
Right.
I get what you're going for. I do have a question for you, and I'm not trying to poo-poo any choice. I just want to kind of ask you, what in your opinion makes this underrated? Because I do feel that Firewatch has been met with a good deal of critical acclaim. So I just want to ask, what in your opinion do you think? Why do you think this game has been overlooked?
I, out of everyone who I've ever asked, have you played this? Everyone says no.
Okay.
I've heard of it, but no. It's one of those things, like, it came out, I think it was just one of those, it hit that indie market that it was either you were going to play it or you weren't. The same way that a lot of people play A Night in the Woods, for instance. People can consider that a hidden gem only if you've played it.
Okay.
You know, I know it's, everyone says it's a good game. Same thing with Spec Ops The Line. People say that that's an amazing game. Like, it's critically acclaimed as being an amazing game, but it fizzles out when it comes to just that mainstream appeal.
Okay. So it's a game that hasn't found mass audiences yet, but right. It could once they watch this episode.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Number three, we're getting close, Tom.
Well, I need to offer another asterisk because, you know, this is a game where I myself want to justify why I think it is underrated. And I want to talk about, you know, specifically Fable 2, but, you know, a little bit overall, the Fable series. This was a huge franchise in the you know, the late 2000s. It was a big, deep RPG, you know, like a Western developed RPG, with a lot of choice elements built into the game, you know, mm-hmm. like a decision you make with one character will influence the rest of the narrative and the world around you. And, you know, the first game kind of overpromised how much those choices would really affect things. But the second one kind of focused and actually did make a lot of those choices feel meaningful. And it's a game where, like, almost every aspect of the world is something that can be interacted with and changed based on your actions.
Right.
And it's a lot of fun. I remember putting a lot of hours into it when I was in college. And Fable 3, I also played through. I think 2 is just, like, the pinnacle of the trilogy. But, you know, there's never been a Fable 4. There was, like, a spin-off game or two, I believe. But this is a series that, like, has just been kind of, like, left to just kind of, like, age and wither away. And I would definitely recommend, you know, if you're looking for a good, long and fun and interesting RPG to get into with, like, some really good lore behind it and a lot of accessible and interesting gameplay choices, check this out. And maybe Fable can see, like, you know, a rebirth from it.
Yeah, I'm surprised because that is, like, a Microsoft exclusive title that just...
It's almost like it doesn't exist at this point. You know?
I think it was Fable Journeys or Journal? Something along those lines.
Or like Heroes or Fable something. It was like, yeah, but it was like no one cared.
Yeah. I know what you're saying though about Fable 2 being pretty much the pinnacle. It was the T2 of the franchise.
Oh, great comparison. Oh my gosh, yes.
But
we're not at T2. We're kind of at Rise of the Machines on your list, if I'm correct.
Yeah.
So, you know, talk to the Tom and tell me what you got.
So, number 3 is D for the PlayStation 1. And it's just
D?
The letter D.
Okay.
I'm not going to tell you what it stands for because it's a spoiler to the game.
Oh, I thought you were going to say it's not safe for work.
No.
It's like, Josh, trying to tell me to get that D?
No. So what D is it's an interactive movie. Let's say very similar to like Life is Strange or like Telltale games and stuff along those lines, where you just control the character, how they go through this interactive movie. But you play as the main character, Laura, who is contacted by the police because her father just had gone on a mass murdering spree inside of a hospital.
Okay.
So when you go to pretty much talk some sense into him, you enter the hospital and you're transported into a medieval castle. And it's just like traps and stuff like that are throughout this. And then you have to play against time or bad stuff is going to happen in the game. It's an awesome game. It shows its age because of the time that it came out. I think it came out in like 95, 96. It was one of the first like big, it was a long box PlayStation 1 game, just to kind of give you some reference.
Okay.
But it is a game that just, I'll just watch a playthrough of it because it's like 45 minutes if you know what you're doing. It's just so enjoyable. But when you find out what D is, you're like, oh my god, like that's even better than like anything that came from this game. But yeah,
awesome. Yeah, that does sound really interesting. I'm definitely gonna have to look into that. Maybe I'll try to give it like a watch through on YouTube or something. I'm sure somebody's got the whole thing uploaded.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of a kind of like a pulpy, you know, like mystery novel kind of thing, you know. Right. And I like that kind of concept.
All right, number 2.
Number 2 is a failed attempt at rebooting a beloved franchise that I think could have gone further. And it is the Prince of Persia reboot from 2009. This was a cel-shaded, a little bit more open world, you know, version of the Prince of Persia franchise that we had come to love from Ubisoft. And after the initial trilogy, you know, with the super popular Sands of Time, and then what is it? It's Warrior Within and The Two Thrones are the follow-ups.
I believe so.
Yeah, so this was an attempt to kind of restart a new Prince of Persia narrative with, like, the prince, and he's in this mysterious kind of, like, you know, exotic desert kingdom, and he's trying to lift a curse that has been put on the land. And I just remember the wall running and melee combat was really fun. The exploration was also great just because of how you could traverse the landscape. Really interesting puzzle solving, lots of stuff to collect. I liked this a lot. I enjoyed the heck out of it. And, you know, it ends on a cliffhanger, which is, like, super disappointing in my book because they didn't continue it. I don't really remember if it was because of, like, you know, bad audience reception or low sales numbers, but they kind of just packed it up. And, you know, we also had a couple years later, I think about 2 years later, we had the awkward bombing of the live action Prince of Persia movie. And then, you know, just from there, I don't know, Prince of Persia's kind of gone dormant, except just, you know, in the fact that original trilogy is well remembered.
Yeah.
But yeah, this reboot, I think it worked. I would have liked to have seen where they were going to go with it.
Yeah, I mean, this is actually a really good pick for a hidden gem because it is one of those games that nobody talks about it. But if you find that one person who has played it, they're like, oh, yeah, that was a kick-ass game. Like, yeah.
Did kick ass. I liked it a lot. And I blame everyone else for ruining it. All right, Josh, you know, this is the final stretch. What do you got up next?
So number two is one of my favorite RPGs of all time. It's a game that didn't come out in America. It's a game that's going to be covered on a Jaeger's Retro Review. And that is Sweet Home.
I know exactly why. Tell him.
It's a wonderful game that has the Dragon Warrior, Dragon Quest, Earthbound battle mechanics to it. It has a permadeath feature inside the game. Like, if your main character dies, any of your characters die in the game, they're gone forever. And you can't continue on with that person. Like, you have to try to pick up their pieces. And it's just so good. And I'm going to be covering a lot more of it. But little known fact about it is the game was remade years later. And it was made into a game called Resident Evil. Because it's so good. And it's so scary. And, I mean, look what it did. It gave us the Resident Evil franchise. Yes, yes, yes. I understand. That means it would have gave us Resident Evil 4. I completely understand. You're welcome, Tom, because my number two gave you your number one.
Oh, Resident Evil 4 is neither my number one favorite game, nor is it number one on this list.
Well, it's your number one favorite Resident Evil game.
Oh, that's true.
But yeah, Sweet Home, fantastic game. I go back and at least play it once a year just because it's so damn good.
Absolutely knew that once you said it, I was like, yep, this makes sense to be on his list. I have not played it myself, but, you know, knowing what I know about it from you, it's something I would love to try it out at some point. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Give me number uno.
Are you ready for my number one?
Yeah, I don't know. You said I'm going to be really upset when
you are, and maybe other people are, but you know what? I have to stan Banjo-Kazooie Nuts and Bolts.
Oh.
A game that there is nothing wrong with. There is nothing wrong with this game.
Okay.
This is a game that attracts a notorious amount of hate from people on the internet. And I think at this point, it's just because it's trendy. Look, I know that there was a huge desire, especially from, you know, Banjo-Kazooie fans such as myself. There was a desire to see a new game that was a fun 3D platformer like the first two games. But what we got, just because it was different, didn't mean it was bad. I mean, if you are a Banjo-Kazooie fan and can look at the concept of Banjo-Kazooie plus Legos and say boo, all I can say is that your inner child, your joy, is dead and gone. The way that you can just have the freedom to construct any kind of crazy contraptions you want and play with the possibilities of the vehicle physics to solve puzzles in this game is delightful. I remember the first time I figured out a way to kind of beat one of the timed challenges in the game faster than I think even the game anticipated I would, because I got really creative with how I built, you know, a hovering vehicle or a car. I just felt so proud of myself. You know what I mean? It's a game that really puts a lot of the solutions in your hands, and it encourages you to be as creative as possible. And it's still got all of the wit and charm and creativity of, you know, the original Banjo-Kazooie games. It's got a wonderful soundtrack. It's got both a really great nostalgia baity level. We're in Banjo-Kazooie land, where you go to a giant museum that kind of shows off parts of levels or things from the past games. And then there's just really unique original levels, like you go inside of a video game console at one point, and you have to traverse all the motherboards and the chips, and you see giant spinning Xbox 360 discs. It's great. If you haven't played it and you think it's bad, you don't know what you're doing, please go play this game and try it out. And if you did play it and you think it's bad, come at it with fresher eyes. It is not the notorious crime against humanity that the internet has made it out to be.
See, the way that you'd say that people treat Banjo-Kazooie, it's a sequel that just strays so far from its predecessors, isn't it? And it's just so weird that everyone hates that game now. It's almost like a certain other franchise out there that has a fourth installment that strayed away from the other ones. But, that's neither here nor there.
Well, it's not exactly comparable because, Resident Evil 4 changed a lot about Resident Evil, and people liked it. You know what I mean? I know you didn't, but I'm just saying, that was favorably received majorly.
Yeah.
But with this one, it changed things and people rejected it. So it's this weird case, whereas in sometimes fan bases love change and sometimes fan bases are no, you've ruined it.
Right.
So, how do you please everybody? I guess you can't, but I defend this game any chance I get.
Okay.
All right, Josh, there's only one more left. And I have to know, what's your cream of the crop?
My number one is a Game Boy Color game from the year 2000. And it looks amazing. It pushed that console to its limits.
Is it a magical game?
It is not a magical game.
Oh, okay. Well, then I don't know.
This game takes place in an alternate timeline of the Metal Gear Solid franchise.
Whoa!
Metal Gear Solid Ghost Babel is the number one hidden gem that everyone needs to play.
Dang, I did not see this coming.
It's one of the only Metal Gear games that really Kojima didn't have much say in. He helped out with the story a little bit, but mm-hmm. he wasn't really hands-on with this. They were setting out to try to recreate Metal Gear Solid on the Game Boy Color, and they create their own story and set. And this takes place 7 years after the original Metal Gear for the NES.
Okay.
It's an alternate timeline where Snake has to go and defeat another Metal Gear, blah, 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 blah,
It can't be.
Yeah, Metal Gear. but one crazy thing about this game was rated E. Even though they talk about racism, infidelity, ethnic cleansing, all kinds of, Metal Gear Solid stuff.
Kids love that. Kids love that. Ethnic cleansing. Kids love it.
It utilized every aspect of the Game Boy Color, and it plays fantastic. It looks great. I really wish more people got the chance to play this, and it is a hard game to find, so may have to resort to an emulator, or if you can find somebody with a physical copy like the one that's sitting behind me right now and Super Game Boy to play it on, by all means, you owe it to yourself. If you are a Metal Gear fan and haven't played this game, you ain't a Metal Gear fan, because this is up there as probably even one of the best Metal Gear games out there.
Okay. That's awesome. Awesome. That's a pleasant surprise that you're number one. I gotta say, very cool.
All right. So there you have it. Me and Tom's top 10 hidden gems.
Absolutely. 20 games you should be playing right now.
Yep. So if you're listening to this and you decide to play any of these 20 games that we've talked about here and discussed, make sure to comment and let us know what you think of them. The one awesome thing I think, Tom, too, is we didn't have any duplicates.
Yeah, that was pretty great.
It's great, like, to know that our ideas of hidden gems are all over the place. Like, mine kind of went through all the years. Yours was kind of in that late 90s to mid 2000s. It's awesome because this is just a wide variety for everyone to be able to play.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, just to increase that wide variety, if any of our viewers or listeners have some hidden gems of their own, please feel free to suggest them to us. We always love trying out new titles.
Yep. And with that, this has been Josh.
And Tom.
We'll see you in the future. Well, that's all the time that we can spend in the past, so thanks for listening. Subscribe to A Cast of the Past on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. And stay up to date with A Cast of the Past by making sure you follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. There you can be the first to know when new episodes drop, as well as joining in on discussions on all things gaming. And until next time, we'll see you in the future.